Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Bigfoot and Company. This is Dr. John, and we are glad everyone can be with us. We've got a great show lined up, a great guest, and first of all, I would like to say good afternoon to my co-host, Matt Delf. How are you doing up there in southwestern Virginia today, Matt?
Hello, I'm doing pretty good. It's not a bad day out this time. The rain actually kind of held off for a little bit today from the looks of it.
Yeah. So, well, we hope you have good weather and get some good good Bigfoot expeditions planned out, because I know you're looking forward to getting back out in the woods as soon as it gets the least bit warm. So
yes.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. Now, my question to everybody is, what kind of house do you think Bigfoot lives in? Well, maybe it's a structure and not a house. But anyway, we've got a guy who's an expert at that. We met him. He was a speaker for us at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference this past October in Kingsport, Tennessee, up at Bays Mountain Park. And he did a great talk, and wanted to bring him on here to Bigfoot and Company and talk a little bit about Bigfoot's houses, these structures, and lots of cool things about Bigfoot. Rick Rellis with BFRO, Bigfoot Research Organization. Rick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, John and Matt. Nice to talk with both of you. Thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Now, you gave a very interesting talk about structures in the woods. And get us started a little bit, kind of recap that for folks who were not at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference.
Yeah, sure. No, I'm glad to. When it comes to structures in the woods, you know, people see them, and you can actually categorize them into a number of categories. I've seen, I think Chris Noel wrote a book with I think he has about 50 different structures listed. I've got them down to about six or seven categories, but they are unique, we think, to Bigfoots, in that they build them in the woods, although I don't know if anybody's ever seen a Bigfoot building one of these. I know I haven't, but I've got, you know, well over 1,000, probably 1,500 by now, pictures of these things. People send them to me all the time. I've got a large collection of my own. And I think you can categorize them into consistent formations that seem, regardless of geography, it seem to be very consistent across the country, North America. They seem to build. And when you come upon these in the woods, they drop into a number of different categories. And, you know, you said a moment ago, John, it could be a home. There is a teepee type structure, which could be a home or a temporary shelter. A lot of the other ones, it's speculation, but what are they? Are they symbols? Do they have some meaning to Bigfoots, or, you know, they put there to give meaning to something, communicating to humans? All of that, I guess, is to be determined.
Yeah, well, they are interesting. And how long have you been studying those particular structures? Because I know you're a guy, you've got your boots on the ground, and you're out there in the woods. How long have you been coming across those and studying them?
I've been interested in stick structures in particular, and categorizing them, studying them, and getting out in the woods and seeing them. I've been active doing that for about 8 years, very, very much getting out and categorizing them. I have a guide, a quick guide to Bigfoot stick structures, that I'm on my third publication on of that. And then you can take it with you in the woods and help you identify them. It's got actual pictures of them in the book. So if people are out there, they can see the different types. And, I'd love to talk about some of those types if you're interested.
Yeah, please do. Now, Matt, just a quick question for Matt. Have you ever come across any of those structures like that?
Some of them. I've seen that, to me, a lot of tree structures are more nature. It's hard to distinguish what the structures, like, for example, you'll find some trees that'll be twisted and stuff. And I've seen trees like my backyard, huge branches just the tree be twisted. We had a storm come through, and a wind gust will only hit one part of the tree, and it'll twist it. Now, I haven't come across any teepees or anything like that, but a lot of times, if there's Bigfoot activity around, I'll look for certain distinct, like on it, whether it was something that had to be done with a hand or if it's like woven in something. It just depends on how it is. But most of it that I've seen is, most of it's all weather. And that's why I was going to ask Rick, you know, how do you determine, how can you tell if it's made by, for example, a Sasquatch, or how can people determine whether it's weather made or if it's, you know, something that's been made by a Sasquatch or something else?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Matt, because, you know, I'm a big skeptic on this first, and I think anybody in the woods that's out looking for these things shouldn't right away assume that what they see, twisted tree or broken branches, were done as a symbol by a Bigfoot. You should always think and ask yourself the question, could nature have done it first? And most, you know, well and beyond the way, you know, most of these things are natural. Snow load in the northern states causes a lot of this with trees to break and bend, particularly like pine trees. Blow down from storms or crosswinds, things like that will definitely, you know, knock down trees in formations that are awkward or unique in different ways. But often in areas where there is Bigfoot activity, where there's been sightings or vocalizations, or Bigfoots are resident or passing through an area, they will build these things. And what makes it unique is you'll see them in a grouping, you know, typically in an area. And then they seem to add over time. If you visit I had research areas in Wisconsin I went to, you know, on a regular basis every week, and I would see these things added over time, week to week to week, and in a particular area. And there wasn't any storm or there wasn't any natural phenomena that would have done this. But in each of the different types, you can look at certain things to help you determine if it was nature that made it or if Bigfoot made it. I'll give you an example. So, you know, one of the types we always look are arches, a loop, or a semicircle. And so when you see one of these, it could be, it has a look of like a St. Louis arch. It's a, you know, tree that's bent over in an arch. And what determines it, what uniquely makes it possibly Bigfoot, and when you see them, they're always in a group and are in one area, is that typically, you know, the root end is still in the ground, but the other end of the sapling of the tree that's bent over, typically the branches have all been stripped off it, and it's clean, and the other end has been made into sort of like a point and forced down into the ground, anywhere from 4 to 6 inches, or uniquely held down by a singular rock. You'll see that that's been placed on it. So in each case, you want to look to see that something has been done that employed hands or a tool or something to make it happen that's unique. And you look at it and you say, well, nature didn't do that. So I agree, you should always be a skeptic first.
I like that, how you pointed out, you know, something made with a hand. That is, that's the key there. I believe I'm looking at some of these structures. Now, a lot of Native Americans used to use, they would bend trees and form trees to mark paths. Do you think Sasquatch does the same?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought up the Native American connection, because I think there is some to it. And you're right, Native Americans would, you know, they would bend trees. They used to call them marking trees, and they would use them to indicate sacred areas or indicate you know, directions to take on paths, path markers, that sort of thing. I was talking with a researcher this past week down in Alabama. As a matter of fact, I just got back from 4 days in the Bankhead National Forest in Alabama about Sasquatch for 4 days there. And he was telling me he believed that Native Americans would bend some of those trees as markers to indicate differentials in land, and land that Sasquatch occupied was on one side and theirs were on the other. So I think there is speculation to that. Now, I think Bigfoots, when they, you know, make a stick structure, whether it's a loop or a hoop or an X, a unique X that stands out in the woods, or an asterisk, you know, those, a lot of those shapes show up and a lot of the signs that Native Americans would use. Do I think that they have meaning only for Native Americans or for humans or for Sasquatch talking one another back and forth? I don't know that. But I do think they're communication tools, similar to what you said with Native Americans.
Now, I have seen the X's, and I've seen grass-fed in areas, and they have like a distinct smell. I've seen another thing that it's not really to do with tree structures, but like when you can tell where a Bigfoot's been active because they're a big animal, and as they're going through the woods up high, the branches, you can see where something has been snapped through, where they've actually moved through something with some size. And I've also seen, I haven't seen it around here, but I'm very interested. Have you seen the Alaska where they turn the whole tree, pull it up, root and all, and then turn it upside down and slam it into the ground?
Yeah.
Have you seen any around that area?
I have not seen those in the woods or in the forest there in North America. And I've gotten out in the woods everywhere from Florida to British Columbia, and a lot of places in between. I have not seen that phenomenon, but I have seen pictures of it in Alaska. And you know, you should talk more. Describe a little more for the listeners what it's about. But these are big trees when they do that.
Yes, they are. There's been it's full size grown tree that has been ripped up out of the ground, a big ball of roots on the end of it, and it's been turned around and slammed back into the ground. And there's been no cracks of any type of, you know, machinery or anything used. The native people there in Alaska, they'll stay away from that area. They tell you, do not go up in there. That's, you know,
right,
dangerous area. It's a warning, is what they claim.
Right.
I was curious, though, if they any been seen around here. I've never seen any.
I have not seen that here, but a lot of people, when they see a large X made in the woods out of two trees, when it's made by Sasquatch, will interpret that as the same thing, Matt. Like, don't go past here, or this is our side of the woods and that's your side. You know, I don't know if that's the meaning behind that. I know in some of the Native American symbols, you know, an X a lot of times can mean a male presence. Because I spent a lot of time trying to correlate these structures and what they look like relative to meanings of similar symbols in Native American culture. And a lot of times it will mean that. The thing about the X you want to look out for, because again, you can get, you know, especially with pine trees, blow down of trees that crisscross each other, lean against other trees in the woods. That's not what we're talking about. But the two members of the X, when you see that, and it's Bigfoot related, typically, again, all the branches have been stripped off up and down the pieces. But they're always the same in symmetry. They're the, you know, they look like they're exactly the same. Like, it took time to find two of trees, strip them of any side branches, and then lay them in a symmetrical manner in an X in an area so it's standing up. Sometimes even it'll be suspended above the ground, so the center point of the X is being held together by two trees that are growing, you know, side by side. And I've seen these things, you know, smaller and some very big, so the members of the X are 20, 30 feet long. I had some folks tell me about an X they saw down in, I think it was in northern Arizona, and they thought it was, you know, they described the two pieces of it. I saw some pictures as being almost like telephone poles. So, you know, it takes some time to do that, to put this together, and they're very consistent, you know, Matt or John, across the country. The X is one of the ones that shows up a lot.
So how long have you been like a member of the BFRO?
About 7 years.
Okay. What got you into the whole Bigfoot thing?
About 10 years ago, I had a sighting. I was traveling with a business associate, and, you know, I think like a lot of folks, we saw something, Matt, that went across the road that, you know, a distance in front of us that we just couldn't get our head around. It was a reddish brown color and appeared to be bipedal and fast and went over a fence like it wasn't even there. And so that got me in. I just couldn't believe what I saw, and started to research, get involved, and then decided I need to get into some expeditions and get out and experience it for myself. And did my own research, had some research areas, and began getting into it in terms of expedition so I could experience more of what this is like, and been doing it ever since. It's it's one of those things that keeps giving.
Right. It gives you a trauma whenever you see something. You're looking at something that's not supposed to exist by our standards, and you're looking at it and you've been told your whole life that's a myth, that's it doesn't exist, but then you're looking at it for yourself, and it changes your life from then on out. You're constantly looking in the woods, and I know for me, that's the past 20 years, that's all I've done, and people may think I'm not, but, I don't care. It's every time I go past woods, I'm always looking. It doesn't matter where I'm at or where. I'm always constantly looking. And I know that, like with you, you guys get a lot of reports from the BFRO.
Right.
Now, do you guys have a database that you guys go by that the public's not aware of, or is it the same database that the public's allowed to look at?
Well, you can go on, the BFRO site. Generally, I think it's BFRO.com, or I think that's right. I spend more time on the other. We have an investigator site, which is not public access, and reports come in of sightings from people. And as an investigator, and I've investigated these for about 4 or 5 years now, our job is to really validate them or debunk them, and follow up on them and see. So you do get a lot of things, Matt, that are hoaxes or misinterpretations or hallucinations. People sometimes, I think, they want to see a Bigfoot because they're interested in it, and then they interpret movement in the woods or a noise or something they see as being generated by a Bigfoot. And so by far and away, there's a lot of reports that are not actual. But no, if we vet out reports and talk to witnesses or go to sites where things occur, we do that. And when we do get some actual ones, they get published and are on the BFRO site, and the public can read those on a state-by-state basis if they'd like. And when it is exciting when you talk to someone and spend some time with a witness, go to the site that they had the occurrence, and in actuality vet it out, and you can tell it's just. It does, to your point, change people's perspective. And I've talked to a lot of hunters, like you said, yourself. I talked to a lot of hunters who just happened to be out in the woods hunting one day, sitting, waiting, and, maybe a Bigfoot Sasquatch comes by, and it changes their life, their perspective. Some of them never go back in the woods hunting again.
Right. Now, see, for myself, I'm independent, I get reports, but I was wondering, I know quite a few BFRO members now, and just kind of curious. They've cut it down to where it's invite only now, but I didn't know if they had anything that maybe a little help from maybe Big Brother or somebody to help you guys locate these or some sightings, but that in general. But you said they had an investigation site, so you guys have access to that the general public don't. That'd be one.
We have, like I said, it's like a funnel. So reports come in, and then we vet out, and then really just publish from there the ones that are valid. So, that's how we do that. But no, there's no Big Brother help on it or any affiliation, anything like that. So.
Rick, I was going to jump in real quick and say, when you talked about when people don't want to go back, I was just speaking with my partner in the South Carolina Lizardman Festival. She's from outside the Columbia area. Her son-in-law and his best friend were out hunting last year. near Lynch's River. In fact, I'm going to have this, I'm going to interview them and get this written up because I think it's a good story. And they were up, both of them were up in the trees. They were a couple hundred feet apart. And all of a sudden, at the same time, both of them had a barrage of rocks and sticks thrown at them. And they got very still, and a little bit later, they both noticed down there at the edge of the creek a large, tall, hairy dude walking. And they called each other and said, "Let's get out of here now." And they've never been back. Because that mm-hmm. will scare you if you see something like that. And I'm going to get the story directly from them. I'm looking forward to it. We'll probably talk about it at the Lizard Man Festival. I mean, because if you love Lizard Man, you love Bigfoot, let's face it. But yeah, it was a good observation that, yes, if you've seen something, because there are places where I've seen things and I do not want to return. And I think that's kind of an important thing, or at least I'm not going to return by myself. I'm sorry, Matt. I just wanted to get that. I thought it was really interesting. You know, when you're starting to put together something like the Lizard Man Festival, no one's really seen Lizard Man in a while, but I'm going to tell you, the Bigfoot stories just come out. I've had five of them told to me as I've been in the Columbia, South Carolina, and Bishopville area, you know, putting that thing together. I mean, everybody comes out here with their Bigfoot stories. So, Rick, I'll have some of these written down for you to take a look at when I see you next.
Okay. Yeah, no, you know, I'd love to talk more about, you know, that kind of thing. They do come out. I think there's more sightings or experiences, et cetera, when it comes to Bigfoot, and it's more commonly held. And let's face it, the Bigfoot phenomena is more commonly talked about and accepted now than it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, et cetera. So more and more that comes up. But who knows, maybe a reptilian type of creature or the South Carolina lizard man, that type of thing will come out. I am aware of that. And you're right, there aren't as many of them. But I think Linda Godfrey writes a lot about those types of things. She kind of categorizes a lot of what people see. And if you read any of her books, you can kind of learn about it. It's crazy, some of the things people see. Pterodactyls and, you know, a variety of different hairy type creatures, wolfmen, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, when I was talking with Lyle Blackburn, he was here last year. God, it's hard to believe it was last year at the first Lizard Man Festival. In his book, he has, I think, 14 sightings, and half of them are brown, hairy creatures. And he said, I couldn't get a bead over whether or not the people who saw the green lizard man versus the brown, hairy creature were, I couldn't understand. It sounded like they were talking about different animals. I said, well,
right.
that's interesting. Now, I know that in Australia, the bunyip, which is kind of their relation to the lizard man, the bunyip can be either green and scaly, or it can be brown and shorter hair. But I think I was always careful to ask folks that I saw, did this thing have like longer hair? And they all said yes. So there have been, just so that you know, there have been some sightings in the forests out there around Columbia and behind Shaw Air Force Base of Bigfoot. And I'll, again, when we get together at Georgia Bigfoot Conference, I'll share some of those with you. I think it's really interesting to see, you know, just the matter of running a festival, how people want to talk to you about it. It's great, and I enjoy it. That's all I'll say, but I just had to get that out there. Bigfoot's just all over. He's a big dude.
I was there with Dr. John, and I had numerous people come up and give their Bigfoot report to me. And it was Lizard Man Fest, and you can ask Dr. John, they come in and they're like, "Where's the Bigfoot guy at?" And they had.
And I was pointing next door, which was right next to me, Garrett, yeah.
There was so many Bigfoot reports. It was unreal in that area. And it's like a swampy area at Bishopville is down there. And I had people, even at the local restaurant, I would go in there and they're like, "Hey, you're at that festival." And I was like, "Yeah." And they'd come up to me and they'd start telling me their reports, all these older people. And they're, what I love about these events, like the conferences, people can come up to you and they can let, you know, they can let that burden that they've been carrying, they can tell somebody about it, not be ridiculed. and you can see how it relieves them when they're able to talk about it. I love it. I absolutely love it. It helps them out. I'm sure you probably get a lot of them at your speakings and stuff like that, where people just get to actually, you know, say, hey, this is what I saw, and with no fear of ridicule.
Well, and so I'm glad, you know, both of you guys have brought up, you know, those two, you know, type of things, because it's true. People, you know, sometimes people carry this around with them a long time before they can get it off their chest, and there is a relief, Matt, to your point. You know, in BFRO investigating reports that come in, you can tell when you've got something that's genuine, because it is just what you just described. People are, you know, they had a hard time coming to deal with the situation. Maybe it was singular, or maybe it was a number of situations over time. And, you know, now they're telling about it, and you can see the emotion. You can see that, you know, it was real. It made an impression on them. But, you know, they can't hide that. So when you do go, and I speak at a lot of these shows, and when you do go to that, people, the line of people that come up afterward and want to talk about their experience, those are the genuine ones. Those aren't the overactive imaginations or misinterpretations or even the hoaxers. These are the real people that want to talk about it. And I think you are providing a service as a researcher and listening to them, or as an investigator and listening to them and helping them understand or come to grips with what they saw or what they experienced. I'd like to get back, Dr. John, to your discussion about the rocks and things, sticks being thrown, and then seeing a large, hairy type creature. You know, in that case, you know, when you talk to those folks, how did they feel when they saw that? Were they, you know, were they afraid or scared, or were they, what impression did it make on them?
I think I've heard different reports. Some folks are scared. Some folks were quite hypnotized and just stood there and watched. I think up at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, I think the best two stories that I heard, one was from what I would say, a very nice upscale young attorney, probably 30 years old. He and his wife came by, and they noticed my little book, Bigfoot Explorers, and then all of a sudden he comes around behind the counter and says, I need to talk to you. And I know you, and Rick, you know what that means, don't you? I got to talk to you, you know. So he explains how he's out hunting. He and his, she was his fiance at the time. They were out hunting in an area in the woods, and they saw what they perceived to be a lizard man. He drew, in fact, I've got it sitting right here. He drew the 3-toed lizard man footprint. And I said, now, do you know much about that? He said, well, no, I don't really know anything about it. I just know that this is what I saw, and I figured if you were up here at the Bigfoot Conference, you'd know about it. So it was really funny. I pulled out my Lizard Man book that I had written and started talking to him, and he described absolutely Lizard Man. Now, he's talking about up in the Mountain Empire area, which is right, you know, the Kingsport, Tennessee area. And then in the same day, I had an old farmer come up and talk to me about Bigfoot, a sighting at the same exact area. Now, it's funny, the young attorney who's got actually billboards all up over Johnson City, so, you know, he's a well-known person. He's got Lizard Man, draws me the Lizard Man foot. And he said, we just watched. It just watched the thing stand there, and then it just went back in the lake. And then the old farmer hands me some hair from Bigfoot. He has a farm right there in that same exact area. So, and I said, well, how was it? He said, well, we were scared. Didn't have a gun. We just kind of like quietly went back, and then we waited a while and went back out. So I've seen the two of them. The attorney, I guess being a little bit younger, he, you know, and the old impervious to doom, which you can be when you're 30 years old, he stood there and watched, and so did his fiance. They were afraid. They were intrigued. The farmer, being a lot more experienced, didn't want to meet up with Bigfoot. He saw definitely a Bigfoot, a hairy creature. So I saw in the same day from the same area, probably within 5 miles of each other, one reported a lizard man type creature, and the other one reported a Bigfoot type creature. The younger one was just, you know, just watching, and they watched until he left. I said, did he see you? He said, yeah. He knew we were there. We could tell. The farmer, he said, we got out of there. He said, I've been around here. I've seen things, and I don't want to have any part of it. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but it was interesting. Two different experiences within 5 miles of each other, an older and a younger. The younger one didn't care. The wanted to watch. The old one wanted to get the heck out of there. So I've seen both of it, and but I have an artifact from each one of them. So there you go.
Yeah, you know, one of the things you mentioned in that story was when there's sightings of a reptilian or lizard man type creature, then in that same area there are sightings of Bigfoot or Sasquatch. I think that happens a lot. I know there's sightings of the lizard man or reptilian type creatures in the Pacific Northwest. We all know there's a lot of Bigfoot activity there. Florida, there are legends and talks, witnesses down there of a dragon man. People write that off as being, gators and that sort of thing, but there are discussions of that down there. And there are skunk apes and the Myakka ape and, Bigfoot type creatures in Florida. I know I did a lot of research in Wisconsin. We had an area, Oconto County, Oconto Falls up there. There were discussions, people witnessed reptilian type creatures in that area. And of the two most active counties in central northern Wisconsin that I had, one of them was the Oconto area. We had loads of Bigfoot reports in that area. And the thing I kept trying to figure out why so many, but the one thing that was common, and I've seen this in other areas too, is waterfalls. When you get a lot of waterfalls in particular geography, it seems that Bigfoot reports come out of that. I don't know what you think, Matt, if you've ever heard that.
I think they travel waterways myself. All the reports and investigation I've done is mostly along waterways. There's either a huge water source, it's either a creek, a river, or a lake nearby. And I guess it's kind of like humans, if we would travel up and down, make cities along rivers, I believe they travel the waterways too. My first sighting was right there where a creek runs into two major rivers, the Wabash River and Tippecanoe River. And Sugar Creek, it was along Sugar Creek that I had my encounter. And I believe they travel up and down like South Arkansas, the swamp areas. A lot of it. There's a big major water source.
Right.
I got a friend up in British Columbia, Mark Johnson. He was wanting to know the difference between the sightings. He thinks that most sightings are in more up in Canada, because he's in Canada, and he thinks that most sightings up in Canada and along, like the West Coast. I believe we have just as many, if not more, through the Appalachian Mountains here, all the way up and down through the Southeast chain, all the way up into, all the way up through Maine. Have you seen, recent reports to see, the comparison, the sightings from the East Coast to the West Coast?
I've looked and keep track, and we have numbers by states where they are, but it seems like wherever there's state, national forest, even county forest, when there's a lot of forest area and water areas, to your point, waterways, rivers, lakes, mountains next to it, places they can get into forested land, greenways, they can travel, national forest, et cetera, they're in there. Moving water, running water, doesn't freeze up in the winter. These are large creatures. They need water for sustenance, and they seem to be in those areas. I've had activity, a lot of activity I've had. I'll scout out areas during the day that have waterways and go back to them at night, for night hikes and things, and they pay off. If you want activity, Bigfoot activity, if you're in an area where there's been sightings, go to the waterways, go to the swamps, and get out there at night, and you got a good chance for activity.
Have you come across any other? Okay, Dr. John Mann, the three-toed lizard man. Now, I know the devil monkey leaves a three-toed track also. Are you familiar with the devil monkey?
I'm familiar with, Dr. John, we were talking, a month ago or so, when we were talking about different types in America, But I know you get reports along eastern Texas and Louisiana and those places of three-toed Sasquatch-type creature. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, it's a three-toed. They run up and down there. It's like a baboon-type animal. I think a lot of it is misidentified for a dog man. They got a tail like a baboon. They're anywhere from, they can stand up from 4 to 6 feet tall. They're very aggressive. I think Pittsburgh, Tennessee had a huge, huge thing back in the 30s where they were kind of remind you of a kangaroo and baboon mix. And a lot of people don't know about them, but they're very aggressive. They'll kill your livestock. But I've seen pictures over in Harlan, Kentucky, and this man, he had a picture of, it appeared to be like a baboon slash wolf face, and it left a three-toed track. And I believe it's a what they call the devil monkey. And I'm kind of curious if that's not, you know, if it's something different than Bigfoot or if it's related, because these things will get down on all fours and run real fast. They'll stand up and walk on two legs also. And I've had some, actually not too far from my house. I've worked with a local vet down here, and they had reported there were 2 horse kills, and these are full-grown horses, just ripped to shreds, nothing ate, just slaughtered, just killed, to be killed. And they told me they didn't know what it was, and so they just had to write it up as a bear attack, because, of course, you know, bears always do it. It's always the bear. And they wrote it up as a bear attack, and then I got talking to witnesses, and I had 4 witnesses described an animal that come running out into a road, and it had a tail. They said it wasn't a bear. These were older women. They didn't believe in Bigfoot or anything like that, but they were looking at something. They didn't know what it was, and they best described it as, it was on 4 legs. It ran out into the road, had a tail. It wasn't a wolf. It wasn't a bear. It wasn't a dog. They said that it had the front legs on it was longer than the back legs. The back legs were more canine-like, and the front was more like arms, but yet they used it to run. And they said it wasn't a hyena, but the closest thing they could say that it looked like would be a hyena. And they said it was super fast, and it moved lightning. It ran out to the road. They got a good look at it, and it bolted, and they said it was gone and couldn't see it no more. And that's the same area of where the 2 horse kills were, and that was this past summer. So whatever this thing is, I'm thinking it's got to be related to the horse kills, being in the same area. So that's why I'm kind of curious about this devil monkey. I was looking up the devil monkey, and, of course, it's known all through the Appalachian Mountains. So
right.
I didn't know if you had come across anything like that or any reports on anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've come across some reports on Pittsburgh. You were saying Pittsburgh, Tennessee. I was actually down through that area a little while ago. I've interviewed witnesses that have described seeing a dogman type creature. You know, one in particular was, you know, almost a shock. He was very, very descriptive of what he saw as a hunter. So, you know, I don't know. On some, again, these things are fewer by far than any of the Bigfoot reports you do get. But, you know, these other creatures, like you mentioned, had a tail, or, you know, they could be smaller, 4 to 6 foot, or whether it's reptilian or it's a canine in appearance, bipedal on 2 legs. You know, people see a lot of different things out there, and you know, it'd be hard pressed to say it's all just overactive imagination.
Right. Now, okay, I asked you earlier if you had help, you know, Big Brother. Now, in my case, I've kind of been shied away there. Big Brother kind of keeps an eye out, and I've been in national parks and places, and I probably talk too much to some of them than what I should. And they kind of try and discourage me from doing things. Have you guys, being part of the BFRO, have you guys been discouraged from searching in certain areas? And, you know, how do they try and go about saying, hey, you know, don't need to go here, the wildlife and any type of park officials or anything trying to discourage you from researching in an area or anything like that?
Discourage. You know, I've talked with other, you know, peers of mine about interactions with, you know, in some cases they're identifying self-identification as they're from a forestry service or rangers, that sort of thing. But then the questions and what are you doing here and why are you here and what can you tell us about, you know, Bigfoot, et cetera, come, it's much more pointed and much more than normal, but not discouraging as like you shouldn't be here kind of thing. I will say, though, that, you know, it's fascinating when you talk with, you know, folks with the Forestry Service rangers about this. They pretty much will, you know, they'll chuckle or smile, laughing, and say, no, no, there's nothing like that here. And they're very close to the vest when it comes to discussing the subject. So, you know, I don't know what influences that. You know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist kind of guy or whatever. And, I haven't, you know, personally been discouraged or been part of groups out on expeditions that have been discouraged by, you know, anybody from a Big Brother type organization that would say, no, you can't be doing this. I am aware of, you know, that type of thing, investigating or going to places we were, you know, days following it, cause I've had reports back from locals and that sort of thing. So, you know, I can't say, you know, I don't doubt what you're saying, Matt, that there is some involvement there at some level, but to be definitive and tell you what it is or know what it is, I can't do that.
Okay. I didn't know if you had had any experience. That's one instance, like one example I had heard from over, I'd go over to Cherokee, North Carolina quite a bit. And
okay.
I talked to some of the natives in that area there, and they call it Eight-Man Caverns. And me and my daughter, we love hiking up there through the Smokies. And they were explaining to us where these Eight-Man Caverns are up in the Smokies. And it's up on the other side of Clingman's Dome. Well, I go and I'm trying to get a map for that area, you know, from the visitor center there. And there's a ranger in there. And I'm like, me and my daughter, we're like, you know, there's some caves in this area. They call it Eight-Man Cavern. And we'd like to have a map, you know, this area, if we could, to try and, you know, map out our little hike out there for that day. And he's like, there was no caves. He totally shut us off. And It was kind of funny because my daughter, she's just like me, though. She's outspoken. And he's like, nope. He's like, there ain't no caves there or anything like that. And I'm like, well, can you give me a map of the area just so we can hike up around that area? And he goes, no, stay away from there. He said, it's too dangerous. And then he just walks away. I mean, he just cut us right off and walks away. My daughter, of course, she's like, well, that wasn't obvious. And it was kind of funny because last week when we had Bigfoot 911, John on here, he had a sighting up there in the same area I was talking about. So that, to me, they know and they shut it down real quick. I mean, we know the government. We know they exist. The government knows they exist. And they try and shut it down real quick, I think, when there's a lot of speculation or whatever. I think a lot of it's probably because of tourists or something like that. But for some reason, you know, the ones that do know, I think, try and shut it down real quick. I'm always trying to catch a young ranger or something, you know, that's new out there, but maybe he can give up a little info or goof up and say something, you know, but most of the ones I come across are pretty shut down and don't really, won't give no info, set you right off. I mean, it's obvious, you know, there's something there.
Good.
Or there wouldn't be. So just, you know, nope, nothing, then turn around and walk away from you. Won't even give you the time of day. They try and cut you off immediately. I didn't know if you guys had a lot of, like for your expeditions and stuff, tell you, no, you guys don't need to be going here, don't need to go there, stuff like that, you know.
Well, you know, I've been, I do a lot of expeditions, help host them and speak at them and do a lot of expeditions with folks in the woods at night, and that's every year in a lot of different geographies. And we always have to permit before we get into an area. Sometimes we're not allowed into areas, but it mostly has to do with, you know, hunting or restrictions on that area, not really for what we're doing. So I would say it's all right. But I want to just touch on, I'd be interested what you, Dr. John, have to say about it too. But I have actually some sympathy for the government in all of this. And you know, I'm going to make a plug here, but I got a book I'm working on, hopefully a spring release. But one of the chapters in there is about this subject. But if you're the government, you got a lot of pressure on you to explain things and know the answers to everything, especially in today's day and age with social media. Everybody thinks they want answers fast. And, you know, you're the U.S. government. The expectation is that you know everything about everything. And so if you go out and acknowledge the whole Bigfoot phenomenon, yeah, it's real. You know, the questions come pouring in, and I don't know that the government can answer all of them. I know I myself as amateur researchers, it's amazing how much I understand about this thing that I didn't know 10 years ago, but I certainly don't know all the answers to it. I got an awful lot of experiences directly with these things that I, you know they exist, but I'm not ready to, you know, answer the questions for everybody tomorrow about everything that has to be known about Bigfoot, because you certainly don't know it. There's still a lot of mystery. I mean, we don't have a lot of facts about it. We have a lot of evidence, but we don't have a lot of proof. And I don't know exactly what constitutes proof, you know, beyond the whole get of a body kind of thing. And then beyond, you know, past one other thing too, I mean, relative to the government, if these things have, you know, the DNA studies that have gone out, et cetera, if these things have any degree of human DNA in them, then, you know, are we dealing with a human element that these things are human? That puts an awful lot of pressure on the government to do right by them too. So I do have some sympathy for the government and understand why, you know, they're not necessarily forthcoming in all of this. And I don't disagree with you, Matt, that they know that they do exist.
Well, I think the biggest thing with them, the only sympathy I really have with the government on this area, of course, you know, the forestry, you would have to make it, you know, especially the Pacific Northwest is an endangered species, so they won't be able to go in and log. But the biggest thing I think was, if they admit that Bigfoot is real, which we know it is, then that opens up, like I heard a little while back, a good explanation would be Pandora's box. You got all kinds of stuff, then they would have to start explaining. And they're not ready to do that. So I do have sympathy for that. They would have to, come out. But as in a part of people not knowing, I come across an aggressive one. And there's kids missing in these forests. There's kids, you know, people, hikers missing. And, you know, I think people should at least be a little bit warned of what is out there in the forest before they just send their, you know, little kids out hiking or something like that, because there's been lots of cases of aggressive animals. And it's not just bears and mountain lions. It's more cryptid. And I've studied a lot of cases with these missing people, missing kids, and a lot of it's Smoky Mountains. You know, I think people should be aware of what they're dealing with if they're going to go into a dangerous area like that. I don't think anybody, you know, should go out hiking like that and that doesn't know, you know, just pretty much, if you don't know your environment, you need to learn about your environment, the woods, stuff like that. But the only way really to learn is to get out there and start doing it. But I think they should be aware of what they could actually, you know, come across. But as far as government on that, I mean, I do, like I said, I respect that. You know, if they come out about Bigfoot, they're going to have to explain a bunch of other things. It's going to open up a whole box of craziness. So I will give them on that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't think they're ready to explain everything about, you know, Bigfoot or Sasquatch phenomena too. And to your point on the disappearances or, you know, being in the woods and everything, and if you take a look at any of the David Paulides books that he's written, I've seen him, I've lectured and listened to that and read most of his books, but, you know, I'm not sure the conclusion is disappearances are cryptid. Could be, maybe not. I'm not sure that the, you know, disappearances in the forests or regions out there have to do with that phenomenon. I agree with you that there's a lot in the Smokies, Appalachians, there's clusters on that. So his research shows those clusters. You can see them mapped where the disappearances take place. And I'm not sure what those, you know, the causes are of those things, if it's singular cause or multiple causes, but I agree with you entirely that, you know, running around out in the woods where you don't know where you are, whether it's, you know, children or adults, if you do that on your own, I think you're crazy. You know, there's nothing wrong with having the buddy system or having a group together when you're out in the woods and around, you know, things happen. You want to be, you know, with folks that can take care of each other. But, you know, there are, it is mysterious, those disappearances. I'll give you that.
Yeah, I'm not saying all of them are cryptids. I mean, we know some of them. There's all kinds of things that could happen. But there's still, you know, even that small percentage of some of them, you know, if you're in a high area of Bigfoot activity or some sort of cryptid, then, you know, well, actually, I believe that they do kind of shy people away from that area without telling them, you know, hey, this is nature reserve. We don't want nobody out here. You know, I think that's their way of trying to discourage people from going into certain areas without actually saying there's something out here. I know that.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Other side of the mountain here, I'd learned this past week, other side of the mountain where I live at, there's been several Bigfoot sightings and reports. And I just found out, actually, it was like 2 days ago, that you can't even go in that forest now because they said they didn't want nobody in there because the government has made it, but they're trying to repopulate the elk in that area, and it's closed off to any public. So, and it's just kind of, you know, kind of funny. That's where a lot of Bigfoot sightings in this area region had come from, but I think that they're getting reports and they're trying to discourage people from going out in there.
Getting back to the earlier topic there, Dr. John, you know, it'd be funny if you got to one of those areas and saw that there were large X-shaped stick structures around the area kind of pointing to you as you approach them. You know, I like to look at that correlation, too. If you could find areas that the rangers said don't go into and see if there are any stick structures in that area off trails. And I've seen these things close to trails or in groupings along trails that people walk. And so I always wonder, you know, what's on the other side if there's activity in that area. But it'd be interesting to make that correlation.
I wanted to respond when you asked about the potential problems. Now, you know, we've all heard from certain researchers that there is human DNA found whenever they test these samples. If there is ever a public announcement that Bigfoot is part human, I don't think our laws are set up to handle that. I don't know how we determine their mental state. I don't know what claims they would have of ownership to land. I mean, it would be the absolute craziest situation for the government. I don't think we'd know how to, I don't think our society would know how to handle it. That you'd have some people going out there wanting to find Bigfoot and talk to him and everything. And you know, Bigfoot might be in a bad mood that day. I think it could be such a problem. That might really be the reason. I mean, it's like, you know, we see all these stories about UFOs and alien contact with the government. I mean, you got the same thing. If you really had something like that come down and all of a sudden they're talking with someone and you've got an intelligent person, you've got an intelligent being that you're talking to, they're immediately in violation of the law. They don't have an authorized identification card. You bring a space alien here, they're not even authorized to exist. They have to go to jail according to law. So our laws are not, our culture and our laws are not built to handle that. And it might be that we have to start looking at that. And then again, we probably don't know how to handle it. And what do they think? What would be, you know, if Bigfoot, you know, and I truly believe that Bigfoot exists. I believe that Bigfoot is sophisticated, more sophisticated than people might know. How does Bigfoot feel about the laws we're going to try to impose upon Bigfoot? Do you, Rick, do you see the major problem that you have and from what I've seen?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was going with directionally with what I was saying before. You know, what do you do? Give them social security numbers? Do you tax them? I mean, do they have claims to land? Do you protect them? Are they the true Native Americans? Well, no, they exist in other countries and places around the world. So that, I mean, what do you do with the whole phenomenon? How do you address it? I don't know. Our government or other governments would do either.
That's the issue right there. How do you address this problem? And it might be better that we coexist and do our best to stay away from each other. Because, you know, but I don't know. You know what? Right now, I don't think you and I know what is going to be going on in 100 years in our world. And maybe we're talking to Bigfoot. And, you know, some people say Bigfoot is this thing that comes through a portal. I don't believe that at all. I think Bigfoot is flesh and blood. And Bigfoot is there. And I don't believe any of the other, although I am certainly open to it. But I just think that I think we've got a mess. Our human civilization is not equipped to handle that. That's where I think a lot of the conundrum comes when you're talking about the government and them wanting to shy away from UFOs, shy away from space aliens, shy away from Bigfoot. And a lizard man, I think, is pretty primitive and not happy. And
right.
So, but I don't think that our society as a whole is ready to handle these problems. So I've talked to so many people in so many different places. It would be stunning if I can't create the list. It would get me in trouble. But you know, I think that's the real problem. We just don't know how to handle it. And UFO thing's gonna be tough one day when something lands and we get a camera crew out there. That, oh my goodness, I think that is closer to happening than Bigfoot. And all the people listening to this can say, John, you're crazy. But that's one thing that we better start figuring out, because again, the minute one of those lands or the minute a Bigfoot walks out fairly sophisticated, they are breaking the law of not having an ID, a birth certificate, social security card.
Right.
Oh my God. What, what do you do? Rick, I'm going to stop my comment on that, because I don't know where to go after that. So there you go.
No, I think what you were saying is true. It does present a problem. And maybe the government's feeling is it's better we live in ignorance as a society on the thing than not. I think what's crazy, you know, Matt mentioned his experiences. I've had experiences where, you know, I've seen these things, Bigfoot. You know, you got groups of hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of amateur researchers out looking for the Bigfoot phenomenon. It's amazing how often we run into it, whether it's sightings or vocalizations or rocks being thrown at us or, interchanges with them or where they, you know, they'll come into their campsites and on expeditions. You know, if this doesn't exist, how can we be a bunch of bumbling researchers in the woods at night? How can we have so many experiences? So, yeah, you know, it's crazy. It's hard to believe that the government doesn't know this phenomenon exists. So it does. I agree with you. You know, you were saying the flesh and blood thing too. You believe it's only that, you know, I was always in the flesh and blood camp on this whole thing. And I think I am basically, my feet are in that. But it's amazing the number of non-physical type experiences people report. And I can vouch and say I've had a number of those myself. So I don't know what to make of that. I think it's an extension of the research, and we got to pay attention to that as evidence as much as, you know, we do castings of footprints.
Yeah, I just want to dignify Bigfoot by saying you're real. You're real. That's all I'm doing. And if the spiritual thing works, I'm actually very thrilled with that. But I at least want to go on the record and say, buddy, you're real. I want to help you. I want to help you come out of the woods and help you come up to Bays Mountain Park and hang out with us. We'd love
it. May happen. You never know.
Yeah,
that's a good thing. It's like I always tell people, you know, you've got three types of people. You got the skeptic that don't ever do anything. You got the people that believe, but they never really experience anything. And then you got the people like myself that know, we're the knowers because we've seen it and we can't explain it. And it kind of opens up your eyes to everything that could be out there. And it's like you was talking about, like, I've always been the flesh and blood. But then here lately, I mean, I've seen some other stuff that, like you're talking about with, like Dr. John said, the portal. I've seen cases where, you know, it circles within circles. And, for example, Skinwalker Ranch, that's where they're doing a big study. And, you know, that these beings come out of this portal out there and a lot of crazy stuff going on. And we've had reports of, like, with strange lights with these Bigfoot. Could be there's been UFO activity around a lot of sightings. What's your take on that? Do you, like, with the orbs, and have you come across a lot of that? And any of your research witnessed any of it?
I have. People report experiences when, you know, with Bigfoot, whether they be, you know, getting images in their mind or hearing things being said, orbs or seeing orb type things, you know, in the woods around where Bigfoots are present, that gets reported a lot. You hear about that. I mean, an eye glow or an eye shine, that sort of thing. So these are things beyond a physical, like Dr. John said, go on over, touch it, and you're physical, you're real. These are things beyond that. I think you got to be, and it seems to be two camps in research on this. There's a camp that's, it's, you know, flesh and blood. I, you know what it is for sure. Like, it's an animal in the woods, flesh and blood. And then there's a camp that's the woo camp, I think it's called, but it's more of a mystical, spiritual, otherworldly, other dimensional, there's all kinds of labels type of creature. I've been around this long enough now that I'm not so sure, I think we're to dismiss one camp or the other and just say it's firmly in this or that one is to, you know, say a lot of the evidence and things that occurs, you know, I'm just going to ignore. And I don't think we want to do that. I think we got to factor in what people experience, what they report, what they see here, what their senses tell them. We got to factor those things in, and it's all part of justification of what these things are. And we're still learning. It's still research. So, you know, I have a tendency to stay very open-minded on this.
Rick, I'm going to jump in. Rick, I got to jump in, and I got to tell you something. I wrote an article on this one time. Even though I certainly believe it's flesh and blood, same thing with Lizard Man, they can't possibly be, because there's something called minimum sustainable population, MSP, and it takes in a contained area at least 750 entities to continue to exist past three generations. That is a biological proven fact. And in these areas, there aren't 750 Bigfoot. There just aren't, you know.
Right.
And so if they're not, well, they must come and go from somewhere else. So as crazy as, I mean, I guess I'm sounding like a real crazy person. I believe that they're physical and real, but they can't possibly be totally. Otherwise, they'd be gone. There aren't, you know, okay, Rick, let's think of it. Matt, let's think of an area, a decent kind of contained area, maybe southern South Carolina, Francis Marion Forest, and going down toward Georgia. That's a fairly contained area of forest. Now, are there 750 Bigfoot out there?
Are you asking?
That is the question. Yeah, I'm saying, are there? Can you find me 750 Bigfoot in that? million square acres down there, or how much it is. And that's my point. If there were that many, I think a friend of mine who's a biologist said if you had 750 to 1,000 Bigfoot in an area, they'd be stumbling all over themselves. They'd be playing hopscotch, and you'd run into them every day. And that's kind of the point. And I think it defies the minimum sustainable population. That's something you can't mess with. It takes a certain amount of entities of a population to continue procreation. And the lizard man, for sure. There were 750 lizard men out there in Scape War Swamp. We'd be stumbling all over them. I mean, it'd be unbelievable. So there you go. Forgive me. I guess maybe I really should change the way I speak about it, Matt. But it's the truth. You just, especially lizard man, for God's sake, not 750 lizard men in Scape War Swamp. There's just not. So where do they go at night? What do? Well, they don't just go hang out down at Harry and Harry too, down there and have a lizard burger. They sure don't. We don't know where they go. And if there were that many, they would be collecting. There would be a collective of them. There would be some type of organized structure, you know, because animals do have organized structures. Birds fly in flocks. I will walk back exactly what I said. I'll say, you know, I believe they're flesh and blood, but my goodness, how does this really work? Because it doesn't work with our, with what we know about biology, and which we know a good bit about biology. And I think they're biological creatures, so there's got to be some type of overlap from the theories and practices that we know about humans and the animals we know, and Bigfoot and the lizard man and the cryptids. There.
Right.
Ugh. Walking something back.
Well, yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm glad you for your listeners, you talk about the minimal sustainable population piece, and that is, I am familiar with that, and have studied that. I have a friend who's an anthropologist on this, and he'll go on, ad nauseum about theory of species diffusion and where a big population will over time settle into all the nooks and crannies everywhere geographically, and then in the end he'll cap it off by saying he believes there's 2 million Bigfoots in North America. So, and you laugh and people laugh, but it's one or two. Yeah, I don't know what the right number is. Any good discussion about this phenomenon comes down to that at some point, just like what constitutes proof. But I'm not really hung up on that, how many there are or not, and where they are, because any of those things comes back into the physical realm very tightly, and why it doesn't fit some model that we know biologically, to your point or whatever. So I'm not entirely sure what we're dealing with is all one or the other. So, but it seems to defy explanation in a lot of other ways too.
You got to put into the factor, do these things migrate? Do they move? Whenever up in where I was at and I had my first encounter, I noticed from the month of December all the way up until about April, there was no sign anywhere. They weren't anywhere around, no tracks, no nothing. And I was out in the woods then because I used to rabbit hunt as a kid and never had any encounters during those period of months. It was always from the spring to the late fall, almost right around the end of November, the encounters in that area. It kind of makes you wonder, do these things move around? Is the population, you got a lot of different things about inbreeding, different clans. A lot factors into that. And like you were saying, the sustained population, a lot of cave systems too. So we don't know really how many, especially along the Appalachian Mountains. Like, look at Mammoth Cave. It's 412 miles of cave. 412 miles of cave. You can go from state to state in that,
right,
underground without any detection. And who's not to say, I know there's caves all around these mountains. So it's very difficult to get a actual, account of how many there are. And some of these areas, you might have one that's wandering trying to find a mate, or, you know, just kind of wandered off course from the rest of the group, or, you know,
right.
It's hard to explain. But, I mean, that is a good theory, though. You know, you've got to have somewhat of a decent population for to even exist. But, he's got a good point, but there's a lot of it, too, that we just don't know, you know, with the cave systems and if they migrate, if they just move around. And there's so much national forest. Oh, my gosh.
Right.
It is crazy.
Right. And there is so much national forest. And when you add in the state forest and the county and everything else, there is a lot of land out there. And I probably have the wrong number, but I knew it at one point. There's like 500 million acres of national forest in the United States, something like that. And then the amount of forest that we actually go into and hike around and look at is minuscule compared to how much is out there. And then because we think, oh, we know everything that's out there, you know, outside of a few forest roads here and there, we don't. And all you got to do is pick up a map of any one of these forests, and there's 6 trails or roads named, you know, Booger's Hollow Road or Devil's Lake or Pond or something. They all have names like that because they were handed down over the years, or somebody somewhere had experiences. You know, what do you want to chalk that up to? So I think there's a lot of these things out there, certainly, and they've gotten to the point they've gotten to by being stealth. And I never think there's a singular Bigfoot unless, like you pointed out, Matt, it's, you know, rogue or exiled or whatever. I think they have a social order and they travel together. I do think they migrate, travel, move around. That helps keep them stealth. I think they're opportunistic and they're eating patterns and things and, you know, go where food is, et cetera. But, you know, I think there's a lot of them out there, and I don't know what the number is.
These are great questions. They're great things to think about. They really are.
They kind of off subject, but what are some of your greatest experiences and like encounters that you've had out in the woods?
Well, no, I appreciate you asking, and you know, I don't know where to start. I will say though, I've had some Class A type encounters, which in BFRO that means you've actually seen it. I did see one back in 2016, in August 2016, on an expedition in northern Colorado in the woods. I was not the only one. Someone else with me saw it. There were 5 of us, and 2 of us saw it. But that was I want to say it was a youth, because to me, I saw it at about 30 yards, standing in the middle of a trail I'd look back on, and it was about 6.5 foot tall, black, completely black, face was black, you could see, you know, the hair, flat face, no neck, you know, sagittal crest for the head, shorter legs, longer arms, you know, a lot of the things you hear in descriptions. But it was funny when I saw it. I don't think it expected us, me and the other person I was with, to look back down the trail, and we were distracted because we were looking up the trail at something else. We had heard them around. There was a lot of noise and interaction behind us in the forest behind us, but because it kind of was doing, you know, if you ever watch a shortstop, you know, rock back and forth from side to side in a baseball game, that's exactly what it was doing. So, you know, we caught it, 2 of us saw it there. It kind of was like, uh-oh, I got caught, I'm stuck. But then I was amazed at the speed when it decided to finally take off and run, and it, you know, got into the woods and, you know, up the hill in the woods, really quickly. So that does stick with you when you see something like that, and that's concrete, you know, in your own mind. You're like, I just saw one, and I can describe it and I could very well because I saw it very well. So those type of things really help formulate. I've had experiences where I knew there were lots of them around. Had one experience back in 2013 with a group, 5 of us on a bridge up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in a huge wildlife management area up there. And it was hard to count. There were so many of them around, and they were in the woods and crossing the path in front of us and going between trees in the forest. And we could see through the moonlight. You know, on the low end, there was 6 of them. On the high end, there could have been 12 to 15 of them. Both, you know, smaller ones that were youth and taller ones. So, you know, and it wasn't like you could see them. They weren't standing right in front, but, you know, you could see the movement. You could see them around. You could hear the noises they were making. You could see the eyes. You know, so, you know, I've been in a, you know, I've been in instances where I've seen them singularly, and been in instances where, you know, where there's a group of them around. So enough to know that they're real. So to get back to you, you know, I've had it, like you said, I've had experiences that I know they're real.
That's a good question. You said something about the eyes. Something I've been researching here quite a bit lately is the eye shine, trying to determine if it's more, I don't know, because, okay, nocturnal animals, all your animals have eye shine except for humans. This is pretty interesting. Okay, you got squirrels don't have eye shine, hogs don't have eye shine, kangaroos don't have eye shine, and I'm pretty sure it's kangaroos that don't have eye shine, but humans don't have eye shine. But it's like 80% of primates don't have an eye shine. So have you, what kind of eye shine have you seen? I'm trying to break it down because I know different colors means different makeup of your body, what's your high end, you know, different levels of your in your DNA, pretty much. A lot to do with diet too. But what have you seen eye shine and like what colors?
Yeah, I have seen it. I can't say I've seen it a lot, but I have experienced it. I have seen it. I can't, you know, tell you how it's generated or if it's reflective or what the physical answer is to it. But I have seen it, and I've seen red. I've seen a color kind of like a cue ball color or regular light bulb, not an LED. I've seen a light blue. So I've seen a few different colors in different areas geographically, not always at the same. It's kind of funny when it does show up, it's a lot like you're looking for it there. All of a sudden it is, in the woods. But, I've seen it enough when they've been side by side, you know, you can see the outline of the head, silhouette, and then the eyes looking at it, and then the eyes turning away or looking down or looking up, doing just like what eyes would do if they're on the face of a human, if you're looking at them in daylight. I've seen like the blinking, if you will, of the eyes. So I don't know physically, I can't explain what generates it, but I have seen it. I know people that go crazy about it and that are, you know, they see it every time they go in the woods. And I don't think that's really the case, but, I have seen some different colors. I've heard reports of an amber type color. I've heard reports of green, you know, green type colors, but, I don't know how to explain, you know, how it happens physically, but it does happen from time to time when you're out there. I'll put this one notion out there and just see what you think. But I think the color of it, depending on the amount of interest on their end, like interest in, like if they're very interested in what they're seeing, you know, in us, or if maybe, you know, they're in a mode of being scared or in a mode of trying to warn us, maybe the color changes or has a different color. Because, you know, if their emotions could change the color or maybe has something to do with the color that we see, you know, I don't know. If you see a pair of red eyes, that's kind of threatening, you know, Matt. So maybe there's a reason for the color we're seeing, I guess.
But if it's a nocturnal animal, they've got the eye shine because it reflects the light out so they can see better at night. And they can take in more so they can see. And like you said, with the red, I forget what it is, but the makeup of the DNA, like their diet and stuff, determines the color of the eye shine, like your deer are green. Of course, you know, they eat a lot of stuff, you know, like the vegetation out in the woods. They're not really meat eaters. So it kind of makes you wonder, and if primates, if 80% don't have the eye shine, then, you know, the DNA makeup of a Sasquatch, if it's the eye part is more towards a nocturnal animal than a primate or a human. So it kind of makes you wonder, you know, what these got a mix of. And, I think a lot of it, I mean, the eye shine helps determine, you know, you can break down certain type of species in animals. But if it's nocturnal, that explains a lot of it, why they're out at night. they definitely could see better, so they're going to have an eye shine. I've heard reports of where they didn't see no eye shine. I haven't seen an eye shine. The one that I encountered, it was dusk. I couldn't, the face, it didn't reflect anything, but I didn't shine a flashlight right on it. I was looking at it trying to figure out what in the world this thing was that was coming through the woods at me, and it didn't want me there.
Right.
But the whole eye shine, I'm really fascinated and been studying a lot on it, and I didn't quite realize that primates, I figured primates would have it, but they, most of them don't. Most primates don't. And
right.
No humans. So it's definitely got a lot of other species other than human DNA also in it, especially for the eye shine. I think it's really intriguing, especially if they hunt at night. You know they got to have some sort of an eye shine somehow, some way to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it comes down to attributes that these things have that, you know, we as humans or primates don't have, because and I'm writing about this actually in the book I'm working on, but I think there's half a dozen type of senses they can employ that they have that we may have had and don't have anymore, or that are unique to them as a species, or so that they can remain stealth or undetected, if you will. But they seem to be able to do some things that are inexplicable relative to what we know about humans or animals and what they're capable of. So you know, I guess I'll leave it at that. I think the ability to shine their eyes or reflect their eyes as they want to is one of them. One of the things on the eye shine thing that I find fascinating is people report seeing one. So, and I personally have experienced that we see one dot, you know, one red dot in the woods, and you know, why are we not seeing two if there's two eyes there? So, but that happens a lot. And you know, seeing one white dot and it moved like an eye, but it was singular and it looked like it was looking at you and then it turned away. You know, how can that be? What about the other one? So, but that gets reported a lot. Another thing is when people see, and I know, you know, from firsthand, but, you know, when you see the face of a Sasquatch and you see the eyes, typically you don't see white of the eyes. You see, you know, just a massive, you know, pupil is like the whole eye is colored. So, and you get reports of that being a brown or an amber color often. So, you know, there's a different makeup here, Matt, is what I'm saying, than, you know, what we can explain.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. Dr. John, have you done any study on the makeup of eye shine or anything particular in that area?
No, I have not, but I can certainly talk to some folks that I know. Right now, I'm just trying to get through the DNA, some of the DNA results that I can get my hands on and all that, which I don't like to talk about too much right now until I really understand it. But in terms of eye shine, that's something I can certainly look at, you know, just because I got some pretty good contacts. So I'll be glad to see what I can do in terms of looking at that. Maybe can talk a little bit about that by the time we reach the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference.
I think that goes hand in hand with the DNA. I think that's a big...
Yeah.
Because...
It's all interesting, and we're all having to walk a fine line between the popularity of Bigfoot and the ability to do scientific research, which is certainly not supported by the National Science Foundation, which I'm a big conspiracy theorist about the NSF myself. I mean, I just, you know, and I don't think my conspiracies are going to be found to be conspiracies a whole lot longer because NSF dictates what R1, you know, the top 100 research universities in America, what they study, because they will not fund certain things. So there, it's left to Matt, what you and Rick called amateur researchers. I don't feel a lot like an amateur, and I don't think you guys are amateurs either. It's just that we're unfunded, unlike some of our colleagues at universities who are funded. And they're producing research that doesn't seem to, you know, it can certainly get published, but its real practical value, I question. And that's kind of what started my movement toward what people call the paranormal. Because in my favorite, famous, and best story is 125 years ago, if you'd looked at someone and said, there's going to be a little small square that you're going to be able to look into, and you're going to be able to speak to somebody halfway around the world in real time, and they would have told you that you were crazy. But we all have one now. It's called a cell phone. And so I think time is going to be a little kinder to those of us who are doing the research, because we're the ones doing it. We're the ones out there with boots on the ground. We're trying to do research. We're trying to learn things. And I think we will be, history will see us in a more favorable light, but we're going to have to compress some time. And it may take 10, 15, 20 or 50 years before we see some results, or those results will be acknowledged. And we all know what the Spanish Inquisition did to good, solid researchers like Copernicus and all those folks. Church did not want certain research to get out. So we've always had that situation. But anyway,
right.
I guess that's my philosophical take on it. We're at a disadvantage because we're not funded. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't be. There are a few journals out there. So-called serious researchers don't care what they have in them. I, for one, think that anything that's reviewed by your peers is probably a good thing. I don't care what the topic is. So I think that as we move forward, the research that the three of us are doing and others will be seen in a better light. And Rick, so your book is going to be out, what did you say, later this year or maybe next year?
Yeah, I would think later this year. I'm working on it. Really, I'm not taking a scientific method approach to it. I'm more, it will cover a number of things. I'm looking more, working title is more like Bigfoot Common Sense, if you will. And I'll have some process in there where I'll look at a type of experience and debrief afterwards. But I'm going to cover a number of topics, so it's informational for readers, but not fall into the camp of, oh, it's all woo, or oh, it's all flesh and blood, and I'm going to now definitively tell you what it is. I mean, I've read dozens and dozens of books, and they typically fall into one category or the other, and I'm not going to take that. I mean, it is what it is. I think I'm not sure we can understand a cryptid entity by just employing the scientific method. And so to your point, on the research thing, it kind of falls apart when you go down that path. Yeah, right. It falls apart when you go down that path. So I'm going to be a little more, filling in the blanks,
oriented,
if you will.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree.
Yeah,
in fact,
observational, but
accurate. I tell you what, we're about to run out of time, but I will say that this is, I like the turn that this has gone, and I'd like to maybe have another time with you and Matt, and let's talk about, there's the British lady. We got 90 seconds. I'd like to talk a little bit more about scientific method and how the scientific method fails in certain instances.
Right.
I mean, scientists don't like the fact that we die because we can't prove it. So
right.
You can't come back and get interviewed. And I apologize for that. There are wonderful scientists in the world, but let's all work together. Well, look, we're running out of time. Rick Rellis, thank you so much from BFRO. We really appreciate you being with us today. We hope you'll come back.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it.
Good. And Matt, thank you as always for being a great co-host. And so we'll all disappear into the woods, look for Bigfoot, do what we can. And Rick, we'll see you at the Georgia Bigfoot Conference at the end of April in Clayton, Georgia, at the Raven County Civic Center and other places where we can hang out. So I want to thank everybody for being with us today on Bigfoot and Company. You can check this out, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, and Spreaker. That will be where it's available if you want to hear it again, or right here at BigfootAndCompany.com. So this is Dr. John saying we'll see you next week. We've got another great guest lined up, and take care. Be careful in the woods.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.